Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, and today's offering is the very intriguing case of 27-year-old Ohio State medical student Brian Schaefer, who disappeared on April 1st, 2006 at a Columbus bar called the Ugly Tuna Saluna after a night of drinking with friends. But if you thought I was about to say he wandered off into the night and was never seen again, or perhaps had some kind of altercation and was abducted, think again. Because if Elvis truly has left the building, the chances are pretty good Brian Schaefer might still be inside. That's how bizarre this case becomes as it unravels. So, let's circle back to the beginning of this tale and set the stage for the events to follow that day. Brian graduates from Ohio State in 2004 with a degree in microbiology, at which point he enters their College of Medicine. During his second year, his mother Renee passes away from cancer. But while this is a difficult development in his life, he's also romantically involved with a fellow medical student named Alexis, with whom he'd become serious. In fact, they had a vacation planned for the week after Brian disappeared, and there was even speculation he might propose marriage during that time. So classes at OSU had just let out for spring break on March 31st, 2006, and Brian met his father Randy early that evening to have dinner at a local restaurant. He expressed that he was exhausted after pulling some all-nighters while studying for exams that week, but was going out that night with some friends to have drinks and let off steam. Now, while this sounds like a reasonable night of fun, we can already account for one factor typical of all types of accidents, which is exhaustion. In addition, we're about to throw alcohol on top to create a curious cocktail. And we're talking hard liquor. Shots. Brian and his wingman Clint did one at each bar as they made their way down the strip, and I'm guessing they were chasing the booze with beer. Now, I don't know precisely how many they consumed, but they started at 9 p.m., and Brian was last seen at 1:55 a.m. at the final bar they visited, which, strangely, turns out to also be the one where they started that night. So, we have a five-hour window in which the subject of this discussion consistently drank hard liquor, but were unable to quantify it. Now, Brian is 6 feet 2 inches tall, which sounds like a sizable dude, except that some reports have him weighing only 165 pounds. So, for a young man whose drinking days had been curbed by academic concerns, at this point in his life, it was more like a night out with the guys, rather than something he was doing on a nightly basis like a young undergrad might. Ultimately, the point I'm making here is that he intended to get pretty drunk, and did so while exhausted. And finally, his friends said it was normal for him to just walk off and leave unannounced. Now, the reason I'm going to focus on those elements is that they're corroborated by the available evidence, and not inserted into the narrative. So, before we proceed here, I'm going to offer my apologies to anyone who's offended by the fact that I'm not going to address this disappearance in a conspiratorial manner, meaning I'm not going to implicate other people, or even other situations, for which there is no foundational basis in making a definitive determination as to what really happened. I'm going to proceed with what we know, and only speculate where we're left in the dark about what happens next due to lack of available facts. With that said, there's a lot of reason to believe that Brian was more upset by his mother's passing than most people realized, and that he had confided in a few people who were close to him that this thing was perhaps a little more than temporary. Some say he was suffering from depression, with suicide a possibility for his disappearance. But if we examine Brian closely, what we see is definitely not somebody on the verge of staging his own vanishing. There's a lot of discussion about this topic, speculation that he might have wanted to take off for a tropical island where he could do something like operate a bar at the beach and play in a band. Of course, it's an interesting theory, and certainly possible, but I don't think it holds true under scrutiny, and it's because history shows that people disappear for many different reasons, and at all times, whether by foul play, voluntarily, or accidentally, with witnesses and without. There isn't any need for Brian Schaefer to stage an elaborate hoax and dodge security cameras, especially when the end result, as we already know, leaves people wondering if he did, instead of giving them reason to believe otherwise. And of course, what we have here is a young man who is seemingly on the verge of proposing marriage to his girlfriend, and has spent a lot of time on their relationship. They've planned the vacation I mentioned previously, and Brian has been working hard at medical school, often pulling all-night study sessions to accommodate the rigorous academic requirements. Certainly, we have to believe he was depressed in light of his words in the aftermath of his mother's death, but what we see otherwise are the healthy mind and body of a young man finding success through hard work and embracing love. Of course, anyone could become overwhelmed by depression, and very quickly at that, to the point of being suicidal. However, we simply don't have evidence that was the case with Brian. Furthermore, a suicide would likely have left his body prone to detection, either by sight or through the smell of decay over time. Beyond that, if Brian was murdered in a robbery gone wrong, we would likely have a body on the street, a witness, camera footage, or similar. Most muggings that end in death don't involve the robber leaving with the body. And if there was some type of conspiracy involving his friend Clint, it's very unusual that there has never been one legitimate accusation of any kind that amounted to anything, in addition to no physical evidence of any kind, or even a legitimate motive. There was speculation Clint was involved in drug dealing, by some accounts, and perhaps Brian knew about it, or was even involved. But again, these claims have never been legitimized. So let's stay the course organically and see what we can come up with. You know, until I'm forced to go off the rails and get a little crazy on you guys. Now let's follow the trail as the event develops. After dinner with his father on the evening of March 31st, Brian does two things. He calls Alexis, who is back in her hometown of Toledo while getting ready for their vacation at the start of the next week, and meets up with friend Clint Florence at the Ugly Tuna Saloon on High Street at 9 p.m., where the two start a night of bar hopping that leads to the Arena District. According to Clint, the two of them hit a bunch of establishments until finally running into Clint's friend, Meredith Reed. She offers them a ride back to the Big Tuna Saloon, where they plan to finish off the night with one last drink. Security cameras actually show them entering the bar around 1:15 a.m. So to get some context for the setup of this place, the bar is on the second floor, and you have to take an escalator from the ground level. So there are security cameras looking down at the escalators, and the images captured are quite revealing, in my opinion. We see Brian at the front of the pack, turned sideways on the escalator, looking back at his friends while leaning against the handrail with his arms spread out to the sides against it. And what that says is that he's not only behaving like the alpha in the group by taking the lead, but his open body posture means he's relaxed and confident. He's smiling, and not in any kind of hurry. So what we know is that we're all constantly engaging a survival game of fight or flight, even emotionally. It's ingrained in our humanity. Yet, while we're looking at Brian on this escalator, absolutely every inch of his body is showing us fight, that he's a lumbering predator in the wild who's just hanging out because he can. We simply don't see flight. There's no nervous body language, no preoccupation with other things. He seems to be fully engaged with the conversation taking place and content to be there. I truly believe what we have here is just a drunk guy going into a bar with the expectation he'll be going home at the end of the night. Also, it's important to note how that apparent confidence could later work against him when his physical abilities are no longer able to follow suit. One common effect of consuming too much alcohol while exhausted is blacking out. In fact, it happens commonly under those circumstances, even when well rested, and is more likely to happen from the consumption of hard liquor due to its quick ingestion and delayed intensifying intoxication thereafter. So, we're going to talk about the psychology of decision making and how the brain alters that process to accommodate emergency situations where there's a need to quickly find shelter from predators in your vulnerable state. So, what we can establish going into the bar, as Brian gets off the escalator, is that our subject looked exhausted before the night began, according to his father, and has now consumed hard alcohol through the better part of a 5-hour window that has brought us to 1:15 a.m. Now, what we should consider here is Brian's normal routine. If he had been pulling all-nighters that week, and was used to doing similar on a regular basis to accommodate his academics, he was likely studying during the late hours of the night, such as our current time on the escalator of 1:15 a.m. The later studying goes into the night, the more likely it's going to take place closer to where one sleeps. So if you're at the library at 8 p.m., you're probably more apt to be at your kitchen table or the desk in your office or bedroom in the middle of the night if you're pulling an all-nighter. Of course, dorm rooms at colleges are specifically designed with desks right next to beds, the idea being that you can slip right into bed when you complete your studies for the evening. The psychology behind this is that we tend to tailor our nightly activities with the intention of transferring ourselves to a place of sleep at the point of exhaustion. So if you're watching TV late at night, or listening to a podcast, you tend to do so in a comfortable place where you can just fall asleep with little to no regard for getting to a place of safety where you can rest and not be preyed upon. The same goes for studying. It's something, especially when done at night, that people generally engage until they become mildly disoriented from exhaustion and lose focus, at which point they go to bed or even fall asleep right there at the desk. The point is that we intentionally and routinely create situations in life where shelter is right at hand when we reach the point of absolute exhaustion. As we begin to get tired, and our movement is restricted, even right down to the speed and accuracy of our thought process, we increasingly become potential prey. But the predator, in this case, is not always other people. It could be, but exhaustion lends itself to predation by the environment, by nature itself, because you can't behave in ways that attempt to break its rules. That's how accidents happen, especially involving alcohol. And here's why. When people are intoxicated, whether they know it or not, they've committed a highly offensive evolutionary crime. The whole point of getting wasted, or even buzzed to begin with, is to, as many people would say, take the edge off. But that edge, that anxiety, is evolution pushing you harder and harder to create, change, build, and grow at all times because it has no other purpose. You refer to it as stress and try to squash it through exercise, drugs, alcohol, pills, etc. All of these things, while some being more positive in nature than the others, are an abomination of our evolutionary purpose. Even exercise is movement without purpose. Its benefits, very much like drugs and alcohol, in that they're temporary. You can be in fantastic shape, stop working out, and lose that condition so rapidly it almost seems like magic. But it's nature. When evolution realizes it's been manipulated, it revokes your rewards, just like with drugs and alcohol. However, if you were to exercise by building a house, the house would remain even if you stopped exercising in the aftermath of its construction. You would retain the reward. And it's because you engaged creation and change rather than manipulation. So, keep in mind as we move forward in this story that Brian Schaefer is going to manipulate evolution by way of alcohol consumption and then behave in an unnatural way due to exhaustion that attempts to conceal him from predators. The first clue we get is his overly relaxed and confident state present on the escalators. He's behaving like an alpha when he's truly drunk and tired. Now, what's interesting about alcohol intoxication is that when you take the edge off by indulging in it, you then also strip away the accompanying evolutionary implications of feeling those stresses. So instead of feeling anxiety that compels you toward the action that fixes problems, the alcohol masks the problems and makes you feel as though you have greater control over life. This elevates your mood and subsequently increases your confidence, but what then happens is you make choices consistent with your new reality. When evolution and or nature are actually still making you abide by the rules that are set in stone. The clash of these ideals can end in disaster, and it's no secret that altercations of all kinds, from arguments to murder, often involve alcohol. Accordingly, seeking shelter due to exhaustion can result in the same pattern of faulty thought. So, back to the bar, we're inside now. Brian, Meredith, and Clint are hanging out. Around 1:55 p.m., security cameras above the escalators outside the bar catch Brian talking to two college-aged girls, apparently fellow students. At this point, he walks off camera in the direction of the bar. Now, we know there isn't another place he could have gone based on his trajectory, and he's seen by his friends inside at that point. According to Clint and Meredith, Brian says he's heading up toward the stage, but then they lose sight of him, and he's never seen again. They wait outside the bar for Brian, but he never emerges. They call him repeatedly on his cell phone, which doesn't have GPS, but get no answer. Time continues to pass, the bar is empty and closed, but there's still no sign of Brian. Police ultimately respond to the disappearance and find no evidence either, even after bringing in cadaver dogs. They go to his home and find nothing missing. Brian's car is parked normally outside where he left it. There has been no activity on his bank account or social security number since that night. For all intents and purposes, he just vanished. I mean, literally. You see, the footage from the security camera by the escalators reveals that everyone who walked in and out of the bar that night was accounted for, except Brian. After checking the cameras for all of the other exits, we get the same. But instead of people stepping back, taking a deep breath, and looking at this rationally, the conspiracy theories go way off the deep end with absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support them. The most common theme among these fabrications is the addition of extraneous elements that aren't supported by the evidence. So, like I said earlier, I'm going to proceed according to what we know. Now, right off the bat, One thing I want to stress is that we have a perfectly normal 2 a.m. situation at the bar going on here. This occurrence with Brian saying he's going to the stage and will be right back, but never arrives, is something that happens at every crowded bar every weekend in America. Now, what we normally later learn is that the person just took off in pursuit of some immediate desire, whether it was sex, sleep, food, or another party, and the tale is recounted with friends over a greasy cheeseburger the next day. Though sometimes the fallout is worse. Maybe a black eye from a fistfight, or even a murder charge. The point is, however, that often these stories are hilarious and simultaneously frightening because you were specifically behaving with disregard for your safety due to the alcohol consumption, but still managed to escape the consequences. Those are the fondest stories we tell. The ones from our youth where we escape the wrath of nature and time, even if just temporarily. And we do that because the debauchery of these incidents perfectly parallels the plight of our youth, a fleeting time when we feel invincible, behaving that way in ignorance of the truth. So, at 1:55, Brian is young, ignorant, intoxicated, and desirous of something we're not able to identify based upon the available evidence. And I think this is where a lot of the misunderstandings involving Clint come into play, many of which are baseless. To begin, we know that Brian was outside the bar, on camera, and in the absence of Clint and Meredith. We can assume at that point, due to the time of 1:55 a.m., with the bar about to close, that Clint is not making any effort to control Brian's movements, especially his freedom to just walk off whenever he likes. Therefore, it's not reasonable to conclude that Clint has somehow masterminded a sophisticated murder plot. He's not influencing Brian's movement. More specifically, he's not restricting it, and because of that very primal notion being true, we don't need to investigate this possibility any further. Of course, many people argue Clint might possibly know more than he's letting on, especially because he refused a polygraph when others agreed. However, I would have done the same thing. Here's why. He went out with Brian that night and is likely on camera at numerous locations doing shots of alcohol with the guy. In fact, he might have even purchased some of those shots. And then his friend disappears in a situation where it seems likely he's no longer alive because of it. I can say definitively that Clint, by way of refusing this lie detector test and hiring an attorney, is trying to limit his liability in the situation. Furthermore, if the two of them happened to participate in the little recreational drug use that evening, and Clint supplied them, guess who could be going to prison if and when a body is discovered and the cause of death relates in any way to that consumption? Of course, that's nothing more than speculation. But the important thing to note is that Clint is doing the right thing by limiting his liability in the situation, and the cops not taking further action suggests they don't have cause to believe there was foul play initiated by Clint. And then we have the theory of a disappearance staged by Brian, which we've already discussed. The circumstances under which his disappearance take place suggest exactly the opposite occurred. In fact, it is 100% a fact that his life would be much harder and less enjoyable in the aftermath of pulling this stunt. He abandoned all of his resources without utilizing anything, even his money. That's what people do when they die. I can't even bring myself to address this theory further. Now, we know there were other exits to the building, including an emergency exit on the side and a back door leading out to a construction site, both of which were covered by security cameras that didn't detect Brian. Now, in researching this, it seems to be the opinion of certain video professionals that it's absolutely possible for a delay in capture to occur in one of these motion-activated devices in dark places at night when a door opens and floods the lens with bright light. Of course, there could have been any number of other glitches causing camera malfunction, thus preventing us from seeing Brian exit the building. Aside from that, there were a couple of other ways out, including by way of climbing down a balcony. But instead of following this trail and being okay with saying I don't know, this is where a lot of people begin to introduce a murderer who either perfectly conceals the body within the building or kills Brian outside and drives the body to the middle of nowhere and buries it. But I call bullshit on this. All of it. Seriously. There is not one shred of evidence he was accosted by another person, and it's especially unlikely to go permanently undetected in an urban environment. In order to believe Brian was murdered or disappeared, you'd have to fabricate a story and other people who are nothing more than fantasy. If he got robbed, shot, abducted, or involved in a fight on the streets walking home, somebody would very likely know about it. So in my best estimation, whatever happened to Brian happened very quickly and was the result of an accident that took place in the absence of others. And we need to understand this. Cliff could just be protecting Alexis from ever knowing Brian was hitting on girls that night and had gone back to the stage to find one in particular. He might very well know exactly what Brian wanted at that time. It could be that simple. But let's proceed with what we know. We know that Brian Schaefer was not detected leaving the bar that night. This either means that he left later by involuntary measures, either abducted or dead, or left alone by way of a method not captured by security cameras, whether through a glitch or doing something such as climbing down a balcony out of sight of the cameras. Now, we have to remember that he was at the entrance, by the escalator, and talking to two girls. It becomes obvious that the young ladies are intending to leave by the fact that they then go down the escalator, and Brian goes back in the bar. So obviously, Brian does not intend to leave, but he has exited the bar to speak to two girls who were in the process of doing so. There isn't any reason he couldn't have said goodnight to them in the bar. In a sense, he's come out here because he wants something, and due to their movement of leaving, can only convey that to them by following them to the point of the escalators. So what we can gather from this, if nothing else, is that he wants to speak to girls. When these two young ladies leave, his desire of speaking to girls is no longer fulfilled. He re-enters the bar at this point and approaches Meredith and Clint. This is when he tells them he's going to head up toward the stage, but his intention is vague. And this is where I think Clint and Meredith might be lying. If they need to leave in about 5 minutes, and Brian walks away without explanation, it's going to be a little odd. It's more likely that they would remind him they're about to leave, and he would say something like, "I'll be right back. I just want to do this or that." Saying you're heading up to the stage to just check out the scene is something you do at midnight, not minutes before close when the lights are coming on. Now, the most common desires in this situation for an adult heterosexual male like Brian, one who's been out drinking all night, would be to either use the restroom, get one last drink, or find a certain girl. It was past last call, and surely Brian would have admitted a quick trip to the restroom before leaving, so we have to believe that either A, he was intentionally vague with Clint and Meredith to thinly disguise his intentions, or B, he told them exactly what he was doing, and his friends decided to not repeat it because it made him look bad. I mean, I'm not making any accusations, but he's a good-looking fellow out partying around a lot of single college women while his girlfriend is out of town. The possibility exists, but we have no evidence of what he actually did. Clint and Meredith claim they lost sight of him. What I think might have happened is he went looking for a girl near the stage, didn't find her, and continued the search to other areas such as outside the restrooms. As this became fruitless, he was probably feeling the effects of the alcohol and exhaustion, and perhaps just wanted to go straight home without the hassle of going back to the car and doing all the goodbyes. Especially if he felt sick. If the alcohol caught up to him, he would be even more likely to wander off in an attempt to get outside. This serves two purposes. One is that he can get sick in a concealed place, and two is he can then evade predators by getting home. And this is where we get those instances of unnatural movement I just described. If he was uninhibited from the booze, but feeling sick and or tired, he might have taken actions to shortcut the normal process of getting home. And we have evidence of that. He didn't leave with his friends, and he didn't leave through the doors. So then, let's examine what I just said about unnatural movements under the influence of alcohol. They're dangerous, and it's because they exist on a plane that runs parallel to reality, but falsely suggests you have greater control over the one involving alcohol. Again, that perceived control is the basis for dramatically increased confidence, and false confidence is the basis for making bad decisions. So, if we don't see Brian Schaefer exit the building, and all of the doors are covered by cameras, we have to believe he most likely did so on his own, and by a method unnatural to the building's intention for allowing visitors to exit safely. And if the bar is on the second floor, high enough to require an escalator ride up to its entrance, it would stand to reason that one who exited the building from that high up, and under the pretense of false confidence and unrealized exhaustion, might become badly injured by an unexpected fall, one from which he couldn't flee very far in the aftermath, except to find the nearest form of shelter because he was incapable of getting help. Now, there was a construction site next door. the type of place ideal for lying down and licking your wounds because it has all sorts of holes, large debris, and dumpsters where you can get lost. One could easily die there, and not be noticed before being covered up by workers ignorant of the circumstances. Cadaver dogs say this didn't happen. Of course, they're not utilized for their stunning accuracy. Their value is in their outrageous level of sensitivity a human could never muster. So, I believe Brian's search for a girl inside the areas of the building where she might be, didn't find her, and then naturally came down from the high of the night to realize it was all over. She was gone, the bar was closing, and more importantly, he was exhausted and just wanted to go straight home to bed. So he made a hasty decision to easily bypass his friends and the goodbyes by exiting the building in a manner he thought he was fit to handle, but was truly dangerous. Even if he was not injured exiting the building, we have to assume he would continue the pattern of shortcuts and might have walked through the construction site or somewhere similar that offered dangerous obstacles where he could fall and risk becoming concealed permanently. Of course, the river was dragged many times nearby. Didn't find a body. So, while the possibility exists that Brian was abducted or murdered, all we really have to go on is an account of the night that suggests he was drunk, exhausted, and alone when he made a decision that resulted in his own disappearance. With a history of walking off unannounced like this, we have no reason to believe otherwise. We simply can't definitively correlate another person to these events, not even vaguely. I believe Brian died from an alcohol and exhaustion-related accident fueled by a bad decision that led to a fall in which he became disoriented, then sought shelter in the nearest place possible while losing consciousness, evidenced by the fact he didn't try to call for help on his phone. When we can't go any farther, we always look for the closest place to lie down. I think that, to this day, his body is under the ground, very close to the bar. The construction site is the most logical and likely choice for this event to have occurred, despite the disagreement of the dogs. Accordingly, I don't think his lack of detection is a mystery. I think it's a clue, a pattern in his choices that dictates it's supposed to be that way. If he got injured making the choice to avoid detection by his friends as he left, the irony is that he did so permanently, and with everyone, due to the nature of his thought process playing out in reality through his actions. In conclusion, I think the biggest clues for me here are the fact that he isn't seen leaving a bar located on the second floor of a building by way of a door, stairs, or escalator, which means if he wasn't murdered and driven out the loading dock in the back, for which there is no evidence, he left the building by way of a window, a balcony, or the roof, none of which is a very good option when you're sober, let alone drunk and exhausted. A second floor balcony or window would be the perfect height in which to have a very serious injury that could potentially be absent of blood. Collapsed lungs, spinal injuries, and ancillary skull fractures are all possibilities. And let's remember that more than 11 years later, nobody has ever talked or even come forward with a false story about a murder conspiracy. And if he was in the islands living it up, he'd have been the victim of countless smartphone pics and videos by now. The world has globalized. I mean, seriously, the thought of escaping to anonymity on a tropical island only goes as far as your all-inclusive wristband at the resort. It's a joke, and something Brian was far less equipped to handle after abandoning all of his resources. Also, because he had potentially died with his apartment and car untouched, we don't have any reason to believe he was hiding anything somebody wanted to keep quiet. The only thing missing in this case is the body of Brian Schaefer. That's always been true. But either way, I hope his loved ones will someday have their answers. In the meantime, as I examine this case, I have to wonder what it is that compels us to peer into the darkness for so long, to hope for answers that might never come, and for reasons that have little to do with our own lives. Until we consider this, every mystery is an opportunity, and nothing more. Yet they all result in a dead end, solved or unsolved, and are something we indulge for the feeling it incites. And that feeling is this. If someone disappears in the absence of reason, then there is something at play in this world, a higher power that has allowed it to happen. And we, as humans, love to chase that notion down the rabbit hole in search of the one time when it will finally be true. that Amelia Earhart really vanished. And so did D.B. Cooper. But the truth is that the only thing that came down from the heavens was their bodies, a predetermined result of the consequences of misguided intentions. And the real mystery is simply the location in which they finally came to rest. So, despite whatever speculation arises in this case, the answer to the riddle permanently resides with Brian Schaefer, wherever he might be, alive or dead. But there's one thing we know for sure, as it's fully ingrained in our humanity. We'll never stop looking, and we'll never stop hoping, because at the heart of our plight is the painful irony of the truth about our search for Brian, a revelation that's almost too heartbreaking to bear, and one that always ends in tragedy, which is this: someday we'll disappear too.